UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Are we all right for sound level?
Yeah, it's okay.
That's fine, okay. Let's just pray. Father, we live in a world which is our world and your world. And so we ask that as we reflect on our responsibility for your world, we ask that you'll give us wisdom, insight, and understanding. Show us how we can understand the problems with the way your world has been abused and treated. Show us how properly to use and respect your world. Give us the mind of Christ, we pray in his name. Amen. When we talk about apologetics in the environment, it's very important that we really understand what the problem is. And the problem is, in one sense, summed up in the word pollution. Pollution not only of the air that we breathe. Now, of course, that's a long-term problem. If in the last century you were to visit London in the middle of the fog, you'd find that the industrial waste that was being burned up in the air had created smog, which would kill often hundreds of people when the whole smog descended. And so the difficulty was fundamentally that the air was polluted. I was spent a year in Arizona and was absolutely amazed at the beauty of the sunsets, until I discovered that the reason the sunsets were so beautiful was because there was so much pollution in the air that the sun as it set was refracted, and this created all the different colours. Pollution is affecting the air. It's also affecting the water that we drink. I was invited to be the best man at a wedding, which is, I always think, a rather odd thing, because usually the best man ought to be the man who's getting married rather than someone else. But I was invited to be the best man, and his father wanted to take me swimming early in the morning. So we went down to the south coast of England, we put on our swimming costumes, and we waded out. He said, "You do have to be careful and not swallow any water," at which point local material from the sewage treatment works floated past. And that rather took the edge off my desire to swim. If you taste water in many, many countries, particularly cities, you'll know that the water tastes enormously of chlorine. And that's the only way we can make it drinkable, because the water is polluted. If you visit many parts of Africa and some in the Middle East, the water there is so infected that children who drink it and have to drink it because there is no alternative end up with horrific childhood diseases and early death and major problems from diarrhea, all because the water is polluted. But sadly, it's not just the water which is polluted, the earth itself is polluted. It's interesting to watch farmers who, in order to feed the world and in order to make a profit, put lots of fertilizers on the soil. The net effect of that on the soil in the long term is land degradation. So what you discover, which looks like a beautiful garden, is really artificially created, but the earth becomes tired. And that requires then more and more fertilizer, which eventually poisons the earth and makes it unusable. If you live near a nuclear reactor, you'll know that one of the side effects from living there, and particularly if there's some kind of leakage, is that the earth itself is affected and unusable for agriculture, for growing, and for sustaining human life. The first problem in the environment is understanding the problems of pollution of air and water and land. But the environmental crisis, which we in the world face, is because also our natural resources are being used up. At the present time, we're in 2004, the price of oil, or as the Americans call it, gas, has reached almost an all-time high. because there is not enough oil in the world to sustain the level of demand. If our populations continue to grow, if we become more mechanized, if we become even more mobile, then we're going to require more oil unless we can produce alternative sources of energy. So the net result, again, is that we are running out of oil. As we have run out of coal, as we are in danger of running out of gas, as we're running out of a whole series of natural resources, of metals, which often have been vital in the whole growth and development of heavy industries in particular, but all industries are now being affected. It's no accident that things like diamonds and platinum are so expensive. It's because they have a rarity value. And as the resources are used up by more and more people, then these resources will not only become more expensive, but eventually will become exhausted. The problem of the loss of natural resources. We also live in a world where there are too many people. It's very interesting that in Western nations, there is, or has been up until recently, a fall in population. But actually that trend is almost stopping. And there's almost a balance between the number of deaths, the number of births. But if you go to many parts of the world, particularly to Asia, you'll find there that populations are growing enormously. Someone says that there is a woman gives birth to a child every few seconds in China. So if only we could find that woman and stop her giving birth, that would solve all the problems of overpopulation. Sadly, it's not quite so simple as that, because for various reasons, in certain countries where there are no social welfare systems, the only way that you can guarantee that you will be looked after in your old age is to find the having of many children. The having of many children means that you will have people who can work the land, you'll have people who will be able to take care of you, and where there is a high rate of infant mortality, the more children, the better. The major problem is that we are overpopulated. Too many people consuming too much of the world's limited resources in too small a space. If you go and visit Hong Kong or parts of Japan, you find that the living quarters are much, much more cramped than they are even in places in Europe. City dwellers live in very small spaces compared with those who are privileged to live in much more rural areas. We're literally running out of space, we're running out of world, because there are too many of us human beings consuming the resources, using up the space, and not being able to develop. Overpopulation. One of the major factors in population movement throughout the world is actually war and the creation of refugees. It's interesting the way that different countries in Europe are struggling to come to terms with how many refugees to allow in and under what conditions. It's true also in the new world of Canada and United States, the new world of Australia and New Zealand, where they're having to put a limit on the number of refugees. Why are there so many refugees? Because they're fleeing from either major conflicts. In the African continent, the major movement of people groups is because of violence, because of warfare, because of tribal disagreement. And so suddenly, small countries are inundated with vast numbers of refugees. Now we can ask plenty moral questions about how are we to care for that. The international community has actually a whole commission for refugees trying to solve the problem. But the movement of refugees affects the world's resources. It affects and often creates environmental crises because suddenly land is required, suddenly space is required, suddenly resources are required, suddenly fresh water, which is drinkable, is required. And so the environmental crisis is often portable. It's created by movements of mass populations. And that stems from war and refugee situation, where people are often fleeing political instability or violence done against them. And if we could somehow solve some of the political warfare kinds of issues, then we would have less of an issue, less of a problem with refugees and therefore of the environmental crisis. It's also the case, of course, that we abuse the environment. For many years, I always enjoyed going to California until it got to the stage where you were almost not allowed to shower. Now, this is the great unforgivable sin in the west coast of America, not being able to shower because there's a search for cleanliness. The reason people were not allowed to shower was because of the amount of water that was being used. And so it was once a week rather than every day or perhaps two, three times a day. In Britain, when there was a water shortage, they said, bathe with a friend. And people wanted to make friends with all kinds of folks so that they could actually save water at the same time as have a good time. We use tremendous water. It's very interesting how often going to the bathroom and toilet, the amount of water which we use. And now, of course, plumbing has created little flushes as opposed to big flushes so that water can be preserved. The amount of water which the average American family uses is roughly about 10 times that which people in many other countries in the world use. If you add that into millions, you're creating an environmental crisis. We abuse the materials that we have. It's very interesting how even when you're cleaning your teeth, how many of us turn on the tap and leave the tap running as we clean our teeth. And all that water is wasted. Every now and then you might perhaps wash out your mouth or wash the toothbrush, and then you keep the tap running while you brush a little bit more. Well, if you do a good job in brushing, you've managed to add to the environmental crisis in a major kind of way. I'm not suggesting, therefore, that you give up cleaning your teeth, but perhaps you change your habit in relation to the taps and the use of water. That's just one small example. We could multiply that in terms of environmental abuse. It's rather frightening to visit oil refineries and to see the gases being churned out in the air. Near where I live in the UK, there is a reactor, a coal-fired reactor. And in order to burn the coal and to produce the power which drives the electricity grid, then the coal has to be burned, and that means the gases have to be taken off. And there's one little chimney which is pointing high up into the air, and from hundreds of miles away, you can actually see this. Partly from space, you can even see this particular gas flume. It's all poisonous gases which are being sent up to the environment. So in the name of creation of energy, so that we can be warm, so we can watch our televisions and listen to our radios and enjoy all the modern benefits of modern technology, we are polluting the atmosphere, environmental abuse. And when we see when contractors move into a green area to create housing, how what was a lovely green meadow overnight becomes a place of mud, and then suddenly houses are built. It's not just the building of the houses which might be a problem, because it might be very appropriately done. It's the amount of land which is required, it's the use of the energy, and the constant abusing of the environment which we as human beings do. It's salutary to visit the French. The French have many interesting habits, one of which is that their beaches are almost totally without litter. In contrast, if you visit the UK beaches, one of the major problems is that people litter. They just open a candy bar and throw the wrapper on the ground. There again, environmental abuse. Now notice, all of these are small things in and of themselves. But when you multiply them by millions, millions of people groups, then you multiply the communities throughout the world. Environmental abuse can be very formalized, or it can be in terms almost careless and without any realization that we are in fact abusing the world. I want to suggest that one of the problems with the environmental abuse is the actual reality of the materialistic lifestyle we have. In the land of the free, in the home of the brave, unless you have a huge helping, you do not regard this as a very good restaurant. In fact, the helpings often are so large, so supersized, which is the phrase for McDonald's, that you can feed probably an army for a week on the strength of what is actually given out as a portion there. that materialistic lifestyle means that the kinds of cars that we drive, which are often gas guzzlers using vast amounts of petrol, are themselves unfriendly to our environment. Back in the mid-60s, I went to Arizona through the generosity of a family who invited me to share the American dream. And when I arrived, they gave me a car. And this was a 1949 Chevrolet. Now, the 1949 Chevrolet was, I think, the best way of describing it, rather like a tank. It was rather like a tank, not only in appearance and not only in the driving, but in the amount of fuel it consumed. Now, the only blessing for me at that particular point was that fuel, gas, petrol, whatever the term you want to use, was very cheap. But I had to use a great deal of it in order to get to my university classes every day. And so it's been interesting over the years to see the cars and the automobiles in the United States literally shrink. Why have they shrunk? They've shrunk so that we can create much more environmentally friendly cars and have much less environmental abuse in the world. The difficulty is that any kind of car, any kind of machine, still requires power to be used. And so the more gadgets we have, the more dependent on those gadgets we are, then the more we use up the environment. One of the changes I've discovered as you move property from the UK to the United States is that buying and selling houses is not the same in different parts of the world. One of the major differences that when I bought a property in the United States, it comes with all the appliances. And of course, everybody wants to make sure they have all the appliances they need. A huge cooker, a washing machine, and a dishwashing machine. Now, I used quite happily, I thought it was wonderful to have a dishwashing machine. I had personally been a dishwashing machine for many years, and so the idea that I was no longer required to fulfill that function was very exciting until I worked out how much water we actually used in putting on the dishwasher. And now we've gone back to that old tried and tested dishwashing machine, that is myself, because that at least doesn't use up quite so much water, particularly as a Scotsman when I have to pay for the amount of water consumed. It's very different, of course, if I wasn't paying for it. We are all paying for it. The world is having to pay for the lifestyle that we have, which doesn't think about the effect, the impact we have on the environment, but rather thinks about our own comfort, our own well-being, and indeed not just our well-being, but our super well-being. A high standard of living, ever higher, ever dependent on more and more gadgets, the environmental crisis. At its simplest, we are running out of earth. We're running out of world. We're running out of resources. We're running out of space. We're running out of the world which was given for us to enjoy. And what's interesting in that analysis of the environmental crisis is there is no disagreement between those who have faith and those who do not have faith. There is common ground that we can develop as we look at the problem of the environmental, the ecological crisis. We can describe the problem in the same kind of way. Now, the causation of the problem and the solutions to the problem and the perspectives on the problem may be different. But in apologetics, there is common ground that we can use in identifying and recognizing the nature, the extent, and the seriousness of the environmental crisis. But it is not only a problem of running out of world, running out of earth, running out of resources, and abusing the space, the world, the resources that we have. It's also a problem of justice. You see, there is a model that many environmentalists use. It's a model of a spaceship Earth. Here we are traveling through space, and the Earth, in a sense, is our spaceship. This particular spaceship is such that we are dependent on air, we're dependent on water, we're dependent on all the resources, and it has to come from within the spaceship itself. Everything else is unfriendly, will seek to destroy human life, so we have to make the most of life within the spaceship. So you would think that would be an argument for us all to share what we had and live together in peace and harmony and justice. The reality is that we live together not in peace, justice, and harmony, but we have two different compartments. In reality, there are many different compartments, but it's an extreme. There's the first-class apartment, where most of the people in the West live. There we travel in luxury. And then there's the third-class compartment, where two-thirds of the world live. They live at a level of poverty. They live in a level where the effect of the environmental crisis, though not felt as deeply in the way that the West feels it, is felt even more deeply because of the problems of disease, the problems of pollution, the problems of lack of fossil fuels to burn, the lack of food, the lack of ability is all present. So the problem, again, in apologetics is one that we can agree. We can agree that there is a problem of injustice which highlights the tensions in the environmental crisis. We are running out of world and we are compounding that problem because of the way in which injustice in the world and our division between nations makes this worse. Sometimes it's hard for people who live in very beautiful rural parts of Western life. I'm thinking of those who perhaps live in the plains of Canada or in the mountains of Dakota. And they say, well, there is no pollution here. The water runs clear. The air is good to breathe. Yes, it's a little bit far. We have to use a little bit of gas to go and buy our groceries, but the grocery stores are well stocked. What is the problem? The problem is that we are one world. We are united in that spaceship Earth. That was brought home to the Brits when Chernobyl nuclear reactor overheated and there was a nuclear accident. A nuclear accident which, of course, destroyed much of that area of Chernobyl, not just in the short term, but in the long term. Many people who worked in Chernobyl died. Many people who survived the Chernobyl reactor problem then began to have children, the children who were severely handicapped because of that nuclear effect. So, of course, for the Ukraine, this was a tragedy, but not just for the Ukraine. The Brits decided that you could no longer eat Welsh lamb. Why? Because the lambs, as they ate the grass on the mountainside of Wales, hundreds of miles away from Chernobyl, were being affected by the nuclear radiation. It wasn't quite that they glowed in the dark, but nevertheless, the effect was such that eating that kind of meat was going to create long-term problems. We live in one world, not just where one person's wage increase is another person's job loss. It's also that we live in a world where when an accident happens, it affects us all. Here's an oil tanker which is passing through an area which has nothing to do with the oil. It didn't produce the oil. It's not going to buy and refine or use the oil. But the oil tanker strikes another boat or strikes some projectile and spills. There's an oil spillage. What happens then? The beaches are covered in oil. The sea life is affected. The bird life is affected. The holiday leisure industry is affected. And so the whole environment becomes fundamentally affected because of pollution from something that has nothing to do with that particular country or the people in that country, either in buying, selling, refining, using the particular product. We are one world. And that one world means that when there are natural disasters, other parts of the world are inevitably affected. One of the main areas of concern about nuclear weaponry, and if we were to use nuclear weapons, heaven forbid, we would be in a setting where the long-term effects of nuclear devastation would affect the world not just for a generation, but for literally hundreds of years. It would make the Earth totally unusable. People would not survive, and we would not be able to use land to grow things, water to drink. Literally, human life would almost become extinct in that particular part of the world, or else would evolve because of nuclear radiation into forms which would be, perhaps to us, quite horrific. We live in one world where we are affected and infected by other things that people do. John Donne used to say that no one is an island. No one is an island, and there are no places of immunity in our world. The environmental crisis is a global crisis. We can all agree, Christian, non-Christian, secular person, Marxist, makes no difference. We can agree that there is an environmental crisis. We can even agree what is the content of that environmental crisis. And I think that gives us a common ground for discussion, for debate. But as soon as we begin to discuss and debate, we discover then that there's a very different view of what has caused the environmental crisis. I want to examine one of the major foci of debates that you find in environmentalist literature. Many people are intrigued the way in which Eastern religion is often embraced, and indeed it forms hypotheses about the nature of the unity of the world. Sometimes that's called the Gaia hypothesis. We are all one and we are all part of the world and we should all function together in harmony with the world, so there are natural biorhythms that we should pick up. That search for Eastern religion is because of a rejection of Western religion. And Western religion, particularly in terms of Christianity. So why are people so unhappy with Christianity? The answer is that for some and for many in the environmentalist debate, the people who are to blame for our environmental crisis in the West, in reality, are Christians and Christian ideology. I want to spend a few minutes just reflecting on the charge which is put against the Christian church, the charge which is put against Christians and Christianity. Christianity is to blame, and the very beginning of the Bible, the first pages of Scripture, show the problem as far as the environmentalists are concerned. God created humankind. He made men and women in His image. But what command did He give them? He commanded them, be fruitful and multiply. And the net result of being fruitful and multiply is that we have far too many people in the world. We have far too many people because people have taken God's command literally and so have produced far too many children. Be fruitful and multiply. The Christian church is to blame. But that being fruitful and multiplying would not be so bad if Christians regulated their fertility. But particularly the Roman Catholic Church has been much attacked and much maligned because it suggests that we ought to have a natural form of family planning, a natural form of controlling our fertility, rather than some kind of intervention or some kind of chemical or other forms of intervention which prevent conception. There's an anti-contraception view among Roman Catholics, particularly from the Roman hierarchy down. And of course, there's much debate about the extent to which practicing Roman Catholics do or do not practice natural family planning, family spacing it's sometimes called, and the very unkind call it Vatican roulette. The environmental lobbyists, particularly when they gather together looking at causes of the environmental crisis, are very quick and keen to blame the Roman Catholic Church because of its view opposing contraception, opposing what it calls artificial contraception, which prevents any kind of natural childbirth. But of course, the command in Genesis was not simply to be fruitful and to multiply. It was also to subdue the earth. And again, human beings, they argue, the environmentalist lobby argues, have taken that command, subdue, and have power over the earth. That in subduing the earth, well, it's rather like a wrestling match. Two falls, two submissions, and a knockout. And rather than work with nature, work in harmony with nature, the charge is that Christianity has encouraged people simply to use the earth for our own purposes, careless of the worth or the value of the earth in itself, and careless of the long-term effects. Simply do whatever it takes, a carelessness about the use of the earth and the subduing of the earth. It's expressed in another command in Genesis where humankind is told to have dominion. Now, have dominion has been taken as a charter for exploitation and a charter for domination. And so in having dominion over whether it's animals, whether it's over land, whether it's over the natural power of the sea or the wind, that has been a domination that human beings have forced either animals or the earth to serve the needs, the purposes of human beings. The command to have dominion has been interpreted as exploitative and dominative. There is another level of complaint about the Christian in this environmentalist attack. Who is to blame for the environmental crisis? Christians. Christians because of Genesis. Christians because of their attitude towards population control. Christians because of their view of domination. And Christians because of the Reformation. It's interesting that there's a very even-handed attack, not just on the Roman Catholic Church for its view of contraception, but on the Protestant Church for its alliance with capitalism. And of course, there have been people like Max Weber and Ron Tawney who have suggested that there is a fundamental link between the development of the Protestantism and, well, sometimes it's been called the Protestant work ethic, sometimes it's been called a Puritan sense of vocation and calling, sometimes it's been called capitalism. Now, that alliance in the minds of many people in the world, and particularly other ideologies in the world, of Christianity and capitalism means that often the blame for capitalist excesses, the claims for the abuse and the justification of the abuses of capitalism, means that Christianity itself, Christian faith, Christian practice, the Christian community, stand accused by the environmentalist lobby of failing to build a proper understanding of our relationship with the animal world, our relationship with the natural world, and the responsibility that we have for that natural world. The charge shows that the understanding of the causes of the environmental crisis caused disagreement. And it's important, of course, that we respond to that, but respond, I think, at two different levels. We have to respond, of course, to the charge and argue our case. But we must also offer an alternative level of explanation. And this is where, of course, the church is able to point to our human nature, point to the fallenness of the world, and the way in which a biblical truth has been captured by the environmentalist lobby as if this was some new understanding. From the very first three chapters of Genesis, we understand that the choices that human beings make and the actions that human beings participate in cause an effect in the world. The environmentalist lobby are telling us that what human beings do affects the air we breathe, affects the water that we drink, affects the land that we use, affects the way that animals are treated. They've discovered some new kind of insight that human beings and their abuse actually affect the world. It's not a new insight at all. It's as old as the book is Genesis itself. It's a result of human sin. And what human beings do in a fallen world is that we affect the world itself. It's interesting in the book of Genesis that the account of the fall is that as a choice the human beings make, there's a breach in the relationship. Breach in the relationship between human beings and God. No longer is there a free, open communion. No longer is there a free conversation. No longer is there a walking in the garden, seeing God face to face and communicating with Him. Instead, now, human beings want to hide from God as if they can escape from Him. But it's not just a breach in the relationship between human beings and God. It's also a breach in human relationships with each other. It's very interesting to hear when Adam is asked why he ate the fruit, why he behaved in this kind of way. This is the first example I can find in world history of passing the buck. God, it was the woman. This is the fundamental breach in the relationship between men and women, where they were in harmony with each other, both equally created in God's image, the one meant to be a helpmeet for the other, both working together in mutuality and in mutual interdependency. And now that communion, that communication is broken. Instead, there's a suspicion. There's a blaming of each other. There's a refusal to accept personal responsibility. But of course, Adam goes even further. It was the woman that you gave me. Look, God, it's really your fault that we have an environmental crisis. If you hadn't been silly enough to create womankind, there'd be no problem at all. So it's really your fault, God. This is the way that human beings try to justify their actions. A breach in the relationship between God and humanity, a breach in relationship within humanity, and then a breach, of course, in relationship with human beings and nature. Instead of a garden, we now have a wilderness. We now have land which has to be overcome, which has to be fought against, which no longer bears fruit in a very natural, easy way, but is full of thistles, is full of hindrances to agriculture and growth. Now it's the sweat of the toil. Now childbirth, rather than being the most natural thing in the world, is a struggle for womankind. And so we find that that communion between humankind and nature is itself fractured, and nature bears that mark. If you read the book of Jeremiah, you'll see some frightening pictures of the way that human sin affects the very devastation and brings about the very devastation of land itself. And that carries all the way through to Paul in the book of Romans. And Paul in the book of Romans tells us that the whole of creation is groaning as in travail, awaiting the redemption of the human body, awaiting humanity being fully redeemed, and then the world will be fully redeemed. That's why in the book of Revelation we can read about the new heaven and the new earth. The earth will be transformed. This world of ours, rather than broken, bruised, battered, abused, will be the world as it was created to be. I always think it's interesting that in the book of Genesis we begin in a garden, in the book of Revelation we end up in a city. There's a view of human progress. We move from a garden to a city, but the difference is that one basic fundamental similarity, that God is at the center of the city. God doesn't come to visit the garden. God resides with his people and his people with God. Christianity needs to offer a response to this attack, offer an alternative, but also, of course, respond to the specific attack. I want to suggest some lines that we can use in terms of how to respond to the attack from the environmentalist. I think we need to always to begin at the beginning. It's very easy. It's very interesting that when Jesus was asked questions about moral issues, so often he'd go back to the beginning. When he's asked questions about divorce, about sexual breakdown, he says, in the beginning, God created. He goes back to the creation pattern. He goes back to God's original intentions in Creator. He goes back to the fact that this is a world which is not our world so much as God's world. The biblical perspective on environmental crisis begins not with humanity, not with the sin of humanity, but with our fundamental moral responsibility. Our fundamental moral responsibility is this world belongs to God. The creation belongs to God. We would not be here, the world would not be here, we would not have worth, and the world would not have worth unless and until God created it. God creates the world and gives it worth and value. God creates humankind and gives it worth and value. The world was good at the end of each of the pictures of God's days of creation. He was able to say it was good. When humanity was created, it was very good. And God completed his creation. We need to go back to a biblical perspective which views the world not through our own eyes, but through God's eyes, and recognizes this world is not our world, but God's world, and we have a responsibility to him as the creator, how we use, how we abuse, and how we use responsibly creation. It's interesting that the biblical perspective in creation recognizes that there is a sense in which human beings are united with creation. We have to beware in apologetics of exaggerating the difference and forgetting the similarity. If you ever go to a funeral, you know there's a very touching moment as they read the passage from the Psalms, man is dust, created from the dust of the earth, and from dust we came and to dust we return. And as people scatter soil, earth, over the coffin in a cemetery or in a cremation service, recognizing that here we have ashes, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We came from ashes, we return to ashes. We came from dust, we return to dust. We are created as the world was created. We are created by God from nothing. Often in debating with scientists in the media, I've been asked the question, debating a scientist who claimed that he could create human life. And I was reminded of a conversation that it was pictured between a scientist and God. And the scientist says to God, "I can create human life." And God said, "Well, that's very interesting. Show me how you do it." And the scientist said, "Well, all you need is you take this little piece of dust." "Hold on a minute," said God. "You get your own dust." Because, of course, the problem is God creates from nothing. We create from material which is already in existence. But that material is a common material. Our bodies are dust. Our bodies are made up. I once remember as a child reading how much soap, how much phosphorus, how much different kinds of chemicals there were in a human body. And they got boxes of matches and all kinds of blubber and fat out to show what the human body would be if you were able to distill it down to all the things. The humanity is part of the world. We're part of the world, yet we are different from the world. Now, we need to affirm both of those truths. We are dust, but we are not only dust. We are part of the world, but we are not only the world. We are divisible. And if you do not believe that you are distinguishable from your environment, then you need to attend one of my lectures. Because when you attend one of my lectures, I have living proof that people are able to disengage from their surroundings. They go into a little world of their own, and they're thinking, how much longer is this guy going to go on? And they're sitting there writing rubbish, 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 trying to remember the jokes. We are able to disengage, we are able to differentiate. I remember thinking there's a difference between man thinking that he is the same as grass and grass thinking that man is the same as grass. There's a consciousness that human beings have. There is an awareness. There's ability to differentiate ourselves from our environment, from our surroundings. We are distinct from the created order. The existentialists fasten on this truth. The existentialists emphasize that the world is there at hand. It's there at hand, and humanity is able to do something with the world. We're able to use the world, to manipulate the world, to abuse the world. We actually decide what we shall do with the world. It's not just there. It's something that we can direct in one direction rather than another direction. We can exercise our will and make different things. Man, the manufacturer. Man who uses his hands and his mind in order to produce something new and different. We are part of the created order, but distinct from it. Part of that distinction in biblical terms is in the notion of responsibility. We could call it answerability, and it's pictured throughout the whole of the Old Testament and the New Testament, but it begins in the early pages of the Scripture. Here in the Scripture, God comes, is pictured as coming for his walk in the garden, and Adam is trying to hide from God, and God says, "Adam, where are you?" God calls humanity into question. It's the same when the sons of Adam fall out and death, murder happens, that the infighting between humanity leads even to bloodshed, to warfare. One brother kills another brother. Cain kills his brother Abel. Then God comes and says to Cain, "Where is your brother?" And Cain's response is, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Knowing full well that he's not been so much been his brother's keeper as his brother's destroyer. God constantly comes to humanity and calls us to respond to him. Now that response, that answerability, I believe, is part of our moral responsibility. That's why in the book of Romans, when Paul is describing the problem of sin, and he's saying, everybody understands sin. The Jews understand sin because they were given the law. They were given the law so they know what it means to fall short of the law. Sin is falling short of the law of the standards of God. "But I'm not a Jew," said the Gentile. "It's not really my problem. If it's not my problem, how can I be blamed for sinning?" And Paul says, well, God has written his law on the hearts and minds of men and women. We are without excuse because there is an awareness of right and wrong. There's an awareness that we are responsible, able to give a response to God, required to give a response to God, which is why the notion of judgment is so fundamental in Christian teaching. It means that from the very beginning to the very end, we stand before the living God, able to give an answer, required to give an answer for all that we say and all that we do and all that we fail to say and all we fail to do, all that we think, our actions, and particularly in this respect, our actions in relation to the world. We are responsible for the world. We are answerable to the world. We are an answerability and responsibility before God. And the picture that the book of Genesis and much of the Old Testament uses to try to describe the nature and the content of that responsibility is the picture of stewardship. The picture of what it means to be a steward is that you live on the land, you live from the land, but the land never belongs to you. The land always belongs to God. But God in his goodness has given us this land to live on. He's given us the earth to enjoy. He's given us all that the earth contains to use for our good, for our flourishing, answerable to him. But that creation, whether it's the world itself, whether it's animal beings, or whether it's nature, all of that ultimately belongs to God. And we are responsible as human beings to God, not to the world itself, but to God for the world itself. Stewardship means that we are entitled to live on and from the world, but we're not entitled to do whatever we want. We're not entitled to do whatever we want because we will destroy the world. We affect the world. Our sinfulness means that there is an environmental crisis. Our self-centeredness means that we do abuse animals and we do abuse the land and the air and the water that God has given us. That's why the picture is the whole of creation groaning as we as human beings continue by our sin, in our sin, to affect the world. And that environmental crisis will not disappear until the eschaton, which is why if you read the books of Isaiah and the books of Revelation, you have a picture of a perfect harmony, a world where everything is in its rightful place, where human relations are restored, where relationships between animals and human beings are restored, where the earth itself is a place of rejoicing and fruitfulness, because there has been a restoration of God's standard and God's rule. The whole of creation is groaning until that moment comes. But until that moment comes, how are we then to live? The Old Testament suggests that the model of the good steward is the shepherd king. The shepherd king is always concerned for his flock, for his people. The shepherd king even names the animals. I always think that picture from Genesis of God saying to humankind, give names to the animals, is rather the way that often we give nicknames to the people that we love. Someone said to me the other day, what's the difference between America and Canada? And the difference is that the husband says to the wife, pass the honey, honey. Whereas in Canada, they say, pass the sugar, sugar. There are terms of endearment that we use. These are nicknames. The giving of nicknames is a sign not so much of control, it's a sign of love. It's a sign of affection. It's a sign of caring. That's why often, of course, nicknames can be used cruelly because sinfully we take a good thing and we can use it for harm and use it for evil purposes. But in itself, the naming is part of what it means to be the shepherd king, responsible for the world and responsible for how we use and preserve and care for the world. If you read the Old Testament law, people often say, why do we have all these Old Testament rules and regulations? We are not the children of Israel. We're not living under that old dispensation. Since Jesus came, everything is new, everything is different. But yet in the very heart of the New Testament laws, we have, if you like, on one level, public health regulations. This is the way that communities need to live together if they're going to live together in justice, if they're going to live together in a healthy kind of way, if they're going to live together so that the land will be fruitful. And that's where the whole idea of Jubilee comes from. It's the idea that it's not just human beings who have to be released from slavery every so often. It's that the earth itself must not be abused and overused. And so you need to give the land a Sabbath. You need to give the land room, space, a jubilee. You need a year where you do not plant, so the earth is given a chance to recover. The jubilee law points to our responsibility as shepherd kings, as good stewards, to use the world in a constructive way and not to destroy it and abuse it. That's part of what it means to be in terms of the new creation. The new creation is something which means that the world matters, as our bodies matter. We ought not to be careless about the body or the world that God has given us. It's going to be redeemed. The world is going to be redeemed. It's going to be part of a new heaven, a new earth, a wonderful transformation. Our bodies will be changed. Our bodies will be transformed. So we have a responsibility then to care not only for our own physical bodies, but for the physical earth, because it's part of that movement towards a new creation. About 3 or 4 years ago, I was looking for something to work on, something to write about. And as I was doing that, I came across a Roman Catholic manual in relation to contraception. And I wondered, what do Protestants say about contraception? So I went to the library and I got out all the books that they had about contraception written from a Protestant perspective. All of the books I could read were all written in the 60s. There was almost nothing written about contraception in our modern world. And I began to listen to pastors and those who prepare people for marriage and discovered that contraception was not regarded as a moral issue at all. Now, if you think a little bit about how medicine works and how contraceptives operate, you realize that at the very heart of the use of contraceptives, there are fundamental moral issues. And I believe, particularly in apologetics, we need to explore some of the perspectives of what it means to reflect before God on the use of contraception, whether or not this is something which is free for anybody to do whatever they want, or whether there are certain forms of contraception which are morally sound and good and healthy and wholesome, and certain forms of contraception which are actually destructive, not only of human life, but actually of human community, human relationships, and human well-being. How are we to understand contraception? How are we to understand capitalism? How are we to understand capitalism? Is it true that Protestantism has been a direct force to produce? It's very interesting. I had a student from Latin America, from Costa Rica. He was a Pentecostal, and he wanted to examine the way in which the Pentecostal are more and more concerned about and committed to social work and social issues, education and social welfare in Costa Rica. He discovered that here were people often in cities who were very poor, people who often beat their wives, often drank too much, often didn't care about their children, weren't good citizens, never mind very good people. And then they heard the gospel. Then they were transformed. Then they were changed. They became Christians. And then they began to stop beating their wives. Then they began to keep jobs. They began to save their money. They began to use their money wisely. They began to be concerned about their children. They began to be concerned about their children's education. And they began to create playgrounds. They began to create schools. They began to be interested in what the teachers were teaching. They began to be concerned about the elderly and the poor. And the movement for the development of social work came about when people were converted. So there is a germ of truth in this idea that Christianity and some expressions of capitalism and concern grow together. The people, when they are changed and transformed, suddenly find the world of work no longer something which is totally foreign and evil, but they try to redeem their work. They try to make some sense of it. They try to use their work in a way which glorifies God. They want God to be in every aspect of their life. Their circumstances, their relationship to their social and their cultural as well as their natural environment is changed and transformed. So we need to unpick the truth which lies in this kind of false accusation and the falsity which lies, which tries to pass the buck and to blame Christians for capitalism and the excesses of capitalism. You just have to contrast the nature and the being and the life of Jesus with the life of what you might call the capitalist fat cats. Nothing could be a greater contrast. The greed, the selfishness, the materialism, which often lies at the extreme form of capitalism. And so we need to unpick and to debunk that charge of Christianity and capitalism, but yet to recognize that the gospel does change and transform people, particularly in their attitude towards nature, towards society, and towards culture. At the same time, I think that we have been too defensive about all of this. I think we need to look very hard at whether or not environmental crises only happen in the Western countries, or whether in Eastern nations, with Eastern religions and all the alleged stress of unity and oneness and monism which is there, actually there is a worldwide environmental problem. And that's because human sin is worldwide and human nature is worldwide. And other religions have not been able to change and transform people's attitude so that there is a proper kind of respect and relationship with the world. I think we're in danger of letting other religions and other cultures off the hook when they should be firmly placed in their blame content for that. I think one of the frustrations that people in the environmentalist debate have with Christians is that Christianity can seem as if it's only interested in the intellect. It's only interested in the debate. It's only interested in the argument. And so they're quite happy to engage Christians and non-Christians in the debate over whether Christianity is to blame. What is the nature of the environmental crisis? What are the causes of the environmental crisis? And they're concerned with how we can get an ideology, a perspective, which might make a change with it. But often Christians have been very slow and very hesitant to actually put into practice the stewardship, the Shepherd King models, the responsibility and answerability of how to live in a proper relationship with the world. We need to develop, I think, strategies for environmentally friendly living. And here is a wonderful apologetic opportunity for the church to practice what it preaches, for Christian communities to show by their the levels of their consumption, by the nature of their consumption, by the responsibility for the world, to use the world properly. It was a slogan which was very much the mark of the 60s and the 70s. It was a slogan which Christians and non-Christians used. It was a simple lifestyle, that we ought to try to retreat from the very complicated materialistic lives that we have and get back to a simple lifestyle. But there was a moral aspect to that. I remember one friend saying, we must live simply so that others may simply live. If we are genuinely concerned for the world, for those who are suffering because of the extremes of the world, we will develop a simple lifestyle. We'll develop a way of helping those in the two-thirds world survive and flourish. And that's when I think there is a very proper debate over the nature of development. I worked with the Black Panther movement in the 60s in the United States. And the plea, often from government, was we want integration. In the black community, they did not want to be integrated into a collapsing community, into what they regarded as a burning house. They wanted to be separate rather than integrated. Often two-thirds world countries don't want to develop as the Western world has developed. It will destroy their culture. It will destroy their familial structure. It will destroy the values and the traditions and the cultures that they have stood for. And so we need to ask, what is a proper view of development? How can we develop nations in a way which is appropriate to their culture and to their particular context, and at the same time preserve the well-being of the environment? So often the West is perceived as saying, you have to live simply so that we can carry on living in luxury, rather than helping develop strategies which will really transform communities, help them grow and develop, and have the things which people want. It's very interesting visiting black families in the ghetto. And you said to often very large families where the men were sadly not present, what do you want? These black families didn't want to be free and separate. What they wanted was enough food to feed their children. They wanted their children to be able to go to good schools. They wanted to have some of the things that they saw on television, for their own families. They wanted to have transport so they could go to a decent hospital. They wanted to have good health care. They wanted all the things that America really stood for, rather than the extreme consumption and materialism which seemed to be the mark so often of American life. They didn't want to be integrated into a materialistic lifestyle. They wanted to have the basics of life and to have them comfortably. I believe that that's often the cry from the two-thirds world. We need to have development with justice. We need justice not only, though, in terms of development and in terms of cultural development. We need, in very practical terms, to look at waste accumulation. Do we want to stop now? Yeah. And Rachel said, let it be warm, and it was warmer. There we go. I'll just have to